walking on a beach in Hobe Sound, Florida. It's a nature preserve. Got protected dunes. Maybe you can hear the ocean. And I like walking on a beach because it's a good place to think. I think I first started really to think about chiropractic philosophy on the beach in South Carolina about 30 years ago. And I was trying to understand what they were talking about with innate intelligence and universal intelligence. And at the same time, I was studying for boards for South Carolina because I thought I might want to go there sometime. So we were sitting on the beach in South Carolina, and after reading the same question over about 10 times, I decided it was useless. And I was just looking out at the ocean. And the ocean was quite calm. But the thing that struck me was its vastness, how big it was. All you could see was ocean. And I realized that if I was a man a million years ago, standing on the same beach, I'd be looking at the same ocean. But at the same time, a totally different ocean. Well, the same ocean in the fact that it probably would be the same color and contain water and have all the natural properties of the ocean, but totally different because all the molecules in that ocean would have changed. There would have been, over the millions of years, rain and then evaporation and then more rain, rivers flowing into it. So the actual consistency of the water would be totally different than it was at that particular time. So it was an idea of it was the same, yet it was totally different. But I realized that that's pretty much the same in chiropractic. You can look at chiropractic in one way and say, well, it's the same as all healing arts, in that our purpose is to try to help people get well, and we perform a specific treatment. We've mastered a particular concept of therapy, the correction of a vertebral subluxation by use of our hands, by something called a dynamic thrust, and we put that into the person's spine and reduce the subluxation, take the pressure off the nerves, and they heal. And that's really not a whole lot different than that concept anyway, than medicine or osteopathy, which is the application of a therapy or a treatment to a human being in order to alleviate his symptoms and allow him to feel better. But on the other hand, it's totally different. Just like the ocean. What we're dealing with is not a treatment. Because in order for it to be a treatment, we have to be able to treat something. And our philosophy is such that we don't acknowledge that that something exists. Now, I want to talk and put it in the perspective of the most common enemy that medicine claims it faces. And what medicine talks about all the time is the idea, the concept of disease. Now, chiropractors, on the other hand, according to philosophy, say there is no such thing as disease. It doesn't exist. Now, in this day and age, that sounds extremely radical. But as I hope you will see in a few minutes, it's not quite as radical as it first appears. The medical doctor, in order to treat something, has to make a decision. And the decision he makes is based on something called the recognition of symptoms. Once he recognizes the presence of symptoms, he then codifies these symptoms and then gives it a name called a disease. The naming of a disease is an art form called diagnosis. That's all diagnosis is. Diagnosis is the codifying of symptoms and then naming it. Now, if they all agree that a particular set of symptoms creates a specific named disease, then that disease enters into reality. It becomes real. And they end up, quote, treating the disease. Now, medical treatment is based on two concepts. The first concept is that the body has been poisoned by something. And the poisoning has created malfunction. Now, things that poison, for example, would be bacterial infection, the poison, the toxins from bacteria, the ingestion of chemicals that are adverse to the functioning of the body, and so forth. The other thing that they enter in is malfunction of a part of the body. Malfunction of a part of the body would be, for example, the formation of gallstones in the gallbladder, preventing the proper expression of bile, or ulcers in the stomach, not allowing proper digestion to take place, or kidney stones, or colitis, or a malfunction of the heart because of some change in the structure of the heart that now does not allow the heart to beat normally or properly. In each one of these, though, he accumulates the signs that he finds, the symptoms, and then attempts to find a chemical that will create the exact opposite reaction. In other words, if he has a patient that has a heart that is beating too rapidly, he would attempt to find a chemical that would slow the heart down, that would interfere with the speed of the heart, slow the heart down. If he found a heart that was beating too slowly, he would try to find a chemical that would cause the heart now to beat more rapidly. This is determined by something called a norm. In other words, the medical doctor assumes that there is a normal heartbeat. The medical doctor assumes that there is a normal pulse rate and so on and so forth, normal temperature. When in reality, that also is not true. There is no such thing as normal. There is only average. In other words, if we took 100 people and took their blood pressures, or 1,000 people and took their blood pressures and divided it by 1,000, that would be the average blood pressure. Now, some of those people would function very well with a higher blood pressure. Some of those people would function very well with a lower blood pressure. But the mean would be the average. Now, they've taken this one step forward and said, no, not only is it average, but it is something called normal. And everyone should be pushed into this zone called normal. So now the physician gives a chemical to change the reaction of the body in an attempt to create normal. And that basically is the practice of medicine. That's what it does. That's pretty much the way it is. There have been some changes in that they've become more technological, and they've created very sophisticated and high-tech instrumentation that enables them to do delicate types of surgery, and just in the hands alone, they've been able to sew fingers on and repair tiny arteries and whatever. And that basically is not so much the practice of medicine as it is the practice of applied technology. Engineers could literally do what the medical doctor. The medical doctor there is not diagnosing anything. He's not involved in healing per se, but is involved in repairing something. He's fixing a torn blood vessel or whatever. And there are a lot of people in medicine today that are very upset with this trend because they think it takes away from their proper place in society, and that people who do this literally are more technologists than they are doctors. But again, that's their problem. We'll let them worry about it. What I want to get back to again is the concept of disease. Because chiropractors have fallen into a trap. We've been sucked into a concept of reality that is really damaging us. And the problem is that it has been so subtle that we're not even aware of the fact that it's happened to us. And that has to do with the concept of disease. Now, I use the term concept of disease very intentionally, because I'm going to tell you right now, there is no such thing as a disease. And I immediately am going to get enormous argument back saying, you know, how can you possibly say that? Well, I want you to think a little bit about what disease is. Now, before the 1700s, which is not that long ago, disease, or the idea of disease, was non-existent. I know that sounds strange, but it really wasn't. It wasn't part of the concept in healing. What we call disease at that time was considered to be a process. It was considered to be a disturbance in function. It was a verb. It was the way the body reacted to something. After the 1700s, specifically after the French Revolution, disease became a noun. Instead of becoming a process, it became a thing. And that idea of it being a thing has just multiplied in reality to the point now where everybody's sense of it is that it is a thing. I mean, think about it. Every fundraising organization, whether it's for arthritis or cancer or tuberculosis or whatever it is, their campaign is always, let's fight tuberculosis. Let's fight cancer. Let's fight nephritis or whatever it is, because they're fighting the thing. They're going to fight this demon now, because the concept of disease has taken away the old concept that existed in medicine in the dark ages of illness being caused by demons. What they've done is replaced the middle age demon now, or the dark ages demon now, with a modern demon, a scientific demon called disease. They've made disease a noun. They've made it a thing. They've made it an entity, something that actually exists as a noun, as a thing. Now, nouns are either what? Names, places, or things. Remember from high school English? Well, a noun is not a proper name, disease. It's not a place, so it must be a thing. But the only thing you can fight is a thing. Well, if it's a thing, then that makes it matter. And if it's matter, then it has to do one of two things. It has to either occupy space and have weight. Well, the question then becomes, how big is disease? How much space does it occupy? Or if it has weight, how heavy is it? How much weight does it have? And the questions are ridiculous, because obviously it doesn't occupy space, it doesn't have weight, it's none of these things. Because again, it's not a noun. It's a process. But is it really a process? Or is it just an abstract concept that is taking on the trappings of reality? Let's examine it from the point of view of probably the most common ailment in mankind, which is the common cold. In the common cold, you have three major sets of symptoms, if you're going to call them symptoms. Number one is the fact that the person with a common cold has a runny nose. The second thing is that a person with a common cold has a fever, usually around 102 degrees. And the third thing is that a person with a common cold either has sneezing or coughing to go along with it. Well, let's examine these things one at a time and see what comes up. Let's look first at the runny nose. The one substance in the body that has the ability to kill viruses on contact, because it tags them, is something called interferon. Interferon is a protein-like substance, and it is produced and carried in the mucin that is located in the mucous membranes of the respiratory tract, the upper respiratory tract specifically. Well, the mucin now, which is a thin, watery substance, carries with it the interferon. The interferon goes and destroys the viruses on contact. The body then produces something called mucus, which is a thick, viscoid type of substance. Acts like a glue. And it surrounds the mucin and the dead viruses and expels them through the nearest opening. And the nearest opening in man is his nose. So the stuff is expelled through his nose. So what it does is it finds, tags, kills the viruses, gathers them all together, and then expels them from the body through the nose. We then collect these specimens of dead virus and mucus, put them in clean, white linen handkerchiefs and carry them around in our pocket. But again, that's neither here nor there. The second thing is fever. The average fever in a cold is approximately 102 degrees. Now, there's a reason for this. The reason that the fever goes to 102 degrees is that at 102 degrees, bacteria become immobile. They don't die at 102 degrees. They just can't move at 102 degrees. But you know what can move? What can move are white blood cells. And what's the function of white blood cells in relationship to bacteria? They're phagocytes. They engulf them. They destroy them. So the body raises the temperature to 102 degrees. This makes bacteria immobile. The white blood cells come now and destroy the bacteria. A very effective defense mechanism. Well, what about coughing? Well, if you remember from your anatomy, the bronchi have on the inside of them millions of tiny cilia. Cilia are little hairline projections that come out into the bronchi, and at the back of each one of these little tiny hairs is a nerve ending. Now, literally, what these cilia are triggers. And when enough debris in the form of mucus or whatever, debris starts to collect on enough cilia, a message goes up to the brain that this condition exists. The brain then sends instruction to the diaphragm to expand and contract violently, thus taking in and expelling air in a violent fashion. As the air is expelled violently, it passes up through the bronchi, picking up the debris and discharging it through the mouth. This is called a cough. Again, a very effective means of defense for the body. So now let's look at what we just talked about. Fever, make the bacteria immobile so the white blood cells can kill them. Runny nose, production of interferon, kills viruses on contact. Coughing, the expelling of debris in the bronchial tract. Now, is the fever, the runny nose, and the coughing now the body's attempt to defend itself against the invader? Well, of course it is. Every sane person in the world would say, yeah, it's the body's attempt to defend itself against the invader. Well, if that's the case, where's the disease? If these symptoms, or what's called symptoms, are nothing more than the body's attempt to defend itself, and it's the body's reaction to the invader, where's the disease? There is no disease. The disease is an idea, a concept, and a false one at that. You prick your finger, and because you've now opened the skin up with a tiny pinprick, bacteria are able to enter the skin, which is, again, one of the main lines of defense. Now, you have bacteria inside of your envelope, inside of your skin. There are three things that happen here. The area gets red. The area gets hot. And the area gets hard. It gets hard around where the needle prick or the pinprick was. Now it gets red because what? It wants to raise the temperature up as close to 102 degrees that it can to make the bacteria inside the skin area now immobile. It gets red because it wants to bring an increased amount of blood circulation to the other, but the blood circulation carries with it the white blood cell, the phagocytes, whose function is going to be to destroy and kill the bacteria. It gets hard because the body packs the skin or the cells in underneath the skin into a wall around the infection, preventing the infection from spreading. So you get heat to make the bacteria immobile, You get redness to get more circulation to the area, and you get hardness to contain the infection. Are these, again, the body's reaction to the invader, or is this the disease? It's the body's reaction to the invader. Well, if that's the case, where's the disease? It doesn't exist. But what about something like diabetes? All right, what about diabetes? Well, in diabetes, you don't get enough insulin. As a result of that, certain parts of the body start to break down because of the high incidence of sugar in the tissues. Very true. But let's look at it. What we're talking about is an organ that is not functioning normally. Not functioning normally. Now remember, the medical model makes disease a thing, not a function. What we're talking about here is function. Now, if that's the case, then the next question I have to ask you is, what determines function? Where does function come from? And now we get into the real hornet's nest of the difference between chiropractic and medicine. The mechanistic view, the medical view of function is that function is determined by a part of the brain that sends messages to a tissue or an organ and gives it instruction as to what to do. It's an on-off switch kind of situation. The chiropractic model is that we have to ask a question first. And the question we have to ask first is, where did the brain get the information from? The medical response to this is, well, it's from the genes. It was inborn in the genes, and that's what gave the brain the information. Well, that's not exactly true. If you cook, you use a recipe. And if you're going to examine what the recipe looks like, it's divided into two parts. There's an upper part of the recipe and a lower part of the recipe. And in the upper part of the recipe is something called the ingredients. Now, the ingredients are the DNA that's found in the genes. Those are all the things that will go to make up the cake or the stew or the roast or the individual, for that matter. Those are the ingredients that make you, you, and me, me, as far as what we are made of is concerned. Well, if I were just to cut off the top of the recipe and give you that and say, okay, bake these cookies, you couldn't do it because you would have all these ingredients now in front of you on your counter, but you would have no idea how to mix them together in order to be able to get cookies. So the bottom part of the recipe then contains the instructions. From a chiropractic point of view, these instructions are the body's innate. So the medical doctors only talk about the ingredients. Chiropractors talk about the entire recipe. We say that you are made up of the ingredients that are determined by your DNA in your genetic makeup. But how these ingredients are organized into something called a Richard J. Santo is purely determined by your innate intelligence. Let's talk a little bit more about what we mean by innate intelligence. Now, this is very simple for us. No, I take that back. It's not simple. It's very hard because people have a great deal of difficulty understanding this concept because it causes them to give up a certain amount of control over themselves that they think they have. If we're going to think about innate intelligence, we have to go back and establish a premise that innate can fit into. And that premise is this. Number one, there is something called a universal intelligence. Universal intelligence means that this intelligence is in every single part of the universe or cosmos. In universes that we haven't discovered yet, in universes that are further than our father's telescopes, this universal intelligence is in everything that exists anywhere. Now, you can call this universal intelligence anything you want. You can name it in anything. You can call it the great creative force. You can call it innate intelligence. If you choose, you can call it God. You can call it whatever you want. The idea is that you have to accept the premise that a universal intelligence exists. Now, this universal intelligence, as far as the workings of the cosmos are concerned, has only one function. And the function, as far as the workings of the cosmos are concerned, is that it is responsible for balance. It's what it does. It balances. It keeps the moon in orbit around the Earth. It keeps the planets in orbit around the Sun by balance. By balancing the forces that exist in the universe. It balances gravity against centrifugal force. It creates what we consider to be reality by various laws involved in particles and waves. It enables us to know who we are by how it puts together the spectrums that exist in light, in time, and in space. And it balances this all out and creates for us the world that we know. Now, the other word for the word that we know, that we're going to use a little bit more, is the world that we know is literally the environment in which we live. So the first thing we have to do is accept the reality of a universal intelligence. Now, the second thing is that there is a personification of this universal intelligence called an innate intelligence. Now, personified, meaning that it is personalized, that it creates something called a self, that it creates a specific unit, and a specific biological unit at that. And if we were to use me for an example, the specific biological unit that it created was something called a Richard J. Santa. Now, how did it do this? Well, it does this by the introduction of a certain kind of force. And the kind of force it uses is something called a life force. Now, I'm going to deviate from what most people refer to as life and say that life is not holy. Life is not special, well, it is, but not in the sense of being supernatural or whatever. Life is a force, the same kind of force that gravity is, the same type of force that electromagnetic energy is. It's a force, but it is a vitalistic force. Let's take, for example, a carrot seed. If we were to take the seed of a carrot and use all the specific instrumentation that is available to us today in order to find the life in the carrot seed, it would be a failure. We can't find life because we have no methods right at this particular time in something as small as a carrot seed to measure this type of energy. But we know it's there from a very practical experiment. And the practical experiment is, all we have to do is plant the seed. And if we plant the seed and the ground is fertile, and it gets enough sunshine, and it gets enough water, then a magnificent thing will happen. The innate intelligence of the carrot seed, the inborn intelligence of the carrot seed, that intelligence that knows how to make a carrot out of a seed, it's in it now, will utilize the life force that it has in order to reorganize the molecules of soil and water in the presence of sunshine and start to recreate those molecules into something called a carat. So the carat is nothing more than the recreated atoms and molecules of the soil and water that surround it into something called a carat. And it does this for a number of days until it finishes building itself. And then you have a carat. Now here comes Richard J. Santo, who happens to like carrots. And I pick the carrot. And I eat the carrot. Well, the innate intelligence in Richard J. Santo, which is the instruction that knows how to make me, uses my life force energy to reorganize the atoms and molecules of the carrot into Richard J. Santo, atoms and molecules. And we get a Richard J. Santo. So the entire organization of my entity, the entire organization of this thing I call my form, my body, is the ability of my innate intelligence to organize through the use of my life force the atoms and molecules of my environment and convert them into Richard J. Santo. That's innate. Innate is responsible for two things. It is responsible for procreation, the continuation of the human species through reproduction, and it is responsible for recreation, the recreation of the individual person by the conversion of molecules and atoms into that person. If this is successful, and there is no interference to either one of these processes, then the human race continues, and the individual continues. Now the innate builds certain systems through which it is able to express its life force. It builds a digestive system, it builds a respiratory system, it builds a bony skeleton that gives it framework, it builds muscles that gives it movement, it builds a lymphatic system that acts as a garbage disposal system, a blood circulatory system that carries blood, and in the blood nutrient and oxygen. And it lives and is functioning from a major system. In fact, the system is so major, it's the first system that it builds. And that system, of course, is the nervous system. Now, the nervous system is where you live. Every other system in your body, every other single part of your body, is there to keep the nervous system alive. Is there to build in survival for the nervous system. Because if you were to have every other single system of your body, but I were to remove your nervous system, you would no longer be. On the other hand, I could remove other systems of your body. I could take away your digestive system and we could feed you artificially. I could take away your urinary system and we could put you on machines to filter your blood and take the impurities out. I could put you on artificial respirators that would take the place of your lungs. But the one system that you cannot remove is the nervous system, because that's where you live. That's where your consciousness is. That's where your non-consciousness is. That's where your identity is. And it's the system through which your innate regulates everything else that's going on in your body. It's the system that allows you to understand that there is an innate. It's the system that allows you to understand that there is a universal intelligence. It's the system that gives you purpose and mission and passion in life. It is the system that chiropractors are interested in. It is the system that we are most closely identified with. And unfortunately, it is the one system that we have not instructed the public to identify with us. I watched a quiz show once, and on the quiz show the question came up, and this was the way it was. What system of the body are chiropractors most identified with? And there were three, it was one of those three-people thing, and all three of them hit the buzzer and whatever it is, and all three people came up with the answer bone. Somebody, I might have said spine, I don't remember, but it was mostly osseous, the osseous system. And the announcer said, no, you're all wrong, it's the nervous system. Now, I don't know who gave him the answer, but God bless them. Because that's exactly the system that we are identified with. And it is the one system that proves the concept of disease is a fallacy. The one system that proves that disease as an entity does not exist. Because in order for disease to exist, it means that the nervous system does not have any power over the rest of the body. It means that the nervous system does not function as a defense mechanism, as a survival mechanism against the effects of environment on the body. And it further means that if this is true, then there cannot be any in it. And this is the position of medicine. Look, when B.J. Palmer and D.D. Palmer first were involved in chiropractic, they threw them in jail, they persecuted them, they did all kind of horrible things to try to stop them. Now, they didn't try to stop them because they were a financial drain on medicine. At that particular period, they weren't even a pimple on the fanny of medicine. That was not the case. The reason that medicine was so up in arms against what these people were saying is because of what they were saying. What they were saying directly threatened the precepts and the concepts of medicine. You want to make something angry? You want to make somebody angry? You want to make somebody really come after you? Threaten the concepts of their religion. That will make people angrier than almost anything else. And if you understand that medicine is both political and religious, you can understand why these medical doctors were so angry when BJ and Didi came out with a philosophy, a concept that directly attacked these archaic principles of medicine. So it's our principles that make us totally different from medicine. It's our principles that make us chiropractors. Not the practice so much, although the practice enables us to materialize or make manifest our principles, but it is the principle. That's what people, most people, if you want, again, in chiropractic, the thing that makes more chiropractors angry is not so much how chiropractors practice, but what they say. The big problem that exists between principal chiropractors and non-principal chiropractors, this is constant of the concept of innate and universal intelligence. This upsets people tremendously because it challenges their belief system. It challenges their preconditioned ideas on their religious concepts. But once you realize it is not a religious concept, but a philosophical concept, and you remove the parameters that enable you from thinking properly about what we're talking about, all of a sudden it makes sense. It falls into place. Medicine is medicine. Medicine, in the direction that it's taking, is a walking time bomb. Medicine has probably created more distress and more damage to mankind than any other single event in the history of mankind. 55,000 people a year die from drug interactions in hospitals. Now, this is not illegal street drugs we're talking about. These are talking about drugs that were given as medicine. And it's probably a lot higher than 55,000, because 55,000 are only those people who died in hospitals from drug interaction. Now, 55,000 is more people than we had servicemen die in the Vietnam War. Now, that war went on for a number of years. We're talking about 55,000 people a year. The introduction of antibiotics into the general population has been an absolute disaster. Now, I know that people who are medically based are going to think that what I'm saying is sacrilegious. But think about it. When I was a young man, or a boy, people died from pneumonia. Certain people, some people, died from pneumonia. And the people who died from pneumonia were those that were weak and not able to function well. In fact, when I was a kid, pneumonia was called the old man's friend. Because when people became very aged and old and were very feeble, when they got sick and it was time to die, they usually developed pneumonia because they weren't able to move anymore. And lying in bed, the lack of motion usually developed a pneumonia. You had interference in the dorsal spine. You had no movement in the lungs. You may have even had the introduction of a bacterial agent. But for whatever reason, they developed pneumonia. And because they developed pneumonia, what happened was that the lungs slowly but surely filled, and they had less and less oxygen. And because they had less and less oxygen, they slept more and more until they finally reached a point where they were no longer able to sustain life, and they died in sleep. It was a very peaceful death. There was very little difficulty involved in it. So it was named the old man's friend. But anyway, after the Second World War, we had the introduction of penicillin. And in the introduction of penicillin, penicillin was used for the treatment of pneumonia. And as a result of that, almost no one died from pneumonia. And that was hailed as being an enormous advance in the annals of medicine, among other bacterial infections that the antibiotic was supposed to have been successful with. So we had this introduction of antibiotics that now controlled bacterial infection. Well, what happened is what always happens in nature, and that is that when nature is threatened in one way or form, or a species is threatened, it starts to build its own defense mechanisms. And what happened was it built its own defense mechanisms in the form of superbacteria. So now we have superbacteria that were now not susceptible to antibiotics, in fact thrived on them. And as a result of that, what we had was now the re-emergence of infectious diseases. Only this time, instead of being from normal bacteria, from superbacteria, to which there was no medical treatment. And now we have an alarming incidence of people again dying from pneumonia. There are now probably somewhere around 5 or 6 diseases that are totally out of control in the world because of superbacteria. There's plague, there's a couple of pneumonias, there's gonorrhea, and I can't for the moment think of the other one. But they thrive on antibiotics. So let's see now, let's analyze what happened since the introduction of antibiotics. Sure, in the 40-year period since the end of the Second World War, people were saved from dying. Some people were saved from dying by the introduction of antibiotics. But the result of the indiscriminate use of antibiotics, the introduction into the general population of antibiotics, has now created superbacteria that has put the entire population of the world at risk. See, the only ones who talk about this now are the infectious disease people. And they don't talk very loudly about it because they realize what's happened. We now have the introduction of very dangerous infectious agents loose in the world. The same is true of vaccinations. How many children have suffered damage from vaccinations? Now, a number of years ago, there appeared in the New England Journal an argument put out by pediatric neurologists. And the pediatric neurologist said that they thought that vaccination should not be mandatory, that it should be purely voluntary, because there was no one who understood what the long-term effects of vaccination were, or inoculation were, on the human body. No one knew, for example, whether the injection of live viruses then would cause cancers later on, individuals who are inoculated. or would open up the body to various other diseases that they would not have necessarily developed without the introduction of the inoculations. Well, the argument created a firestorm because all the regular pediatricians went nuts. And as a result of that, they screamed and yelled and shut down the pediatric neurologists because they didn't want to hear this because too much of their income is based on the introduction of inoculations into the population. Well, now we find out, for example, that in the 1950s and 1960s, with the introduction of oral polio vaccine, that a large amount of that vaccine was contaminated. Not only was it contaminated, the producers of the vaccine knew it was contaminated and gave it out anyway. And that vaccine now is causing cancers in people who have taken it. Now that would be bad enough, except for the fact that the gene, the disturbed gene, that the contaminated polio vaccine caused when it was taken in now, is being passed on to the offspring of those people. So not only is the patient who took the vaccine now susceptible in developing the cancer, but the offspring of those people now are developing cancer. Medicine is probably the greatest threat to mankind on the face of the earth. And unless we become a little more militant as to our position as far as the general population is concerned, they will continue to do this. We have to take a stand, and the stand we have to take is one in which we explain clearly and concisely exactly what chiropractic is. We have to get our national organizations to do this. We have to get individual chiropractors to do this. I mean, do we have to have an Ebola outbreak that kills off 90% of the population before we stand up and say, whoa, enough of this? If the virus in the polio vaccine now is causing cancer, could it be possible that a virus in smallpox vaccination created the AIDS epidemic that started in Africa? I mean, who knows? I mean, even if they do know, they're not going to tell us. It's time for us to stand up and be counted. It's time for us to stand up and take a stand on what we're doing. The more you think about what chiropractors are and what they do, the more you understand the need for chiropractic. See, not only does the need have to be conscious, because I don't think necessarily it's always conscious, but it's also non-conscious. For example, when chiropractors go to Haiti and go into the mountains and do not speak French or Creole, which is what the natives understand. Thing that looks like somebody is hitting somebody or putting a force if you have no understanding of it. How do they know this is good for them? But they flock by the thousands. A chiropractor goes to Chile where there is no such thing. Chiropractic is not even recognized as anything. Or goes to Peru, and the same thing. And within weeks, there are hundreds upon hundreds of people lining up to get adjusted. What is this thing that innate does between people that makes them understand this? Chiropractic is right. Chiropractic is true. We're in the right place at the right time. All we have to do is do what we know how to do. I really believe that every single one of us, before we die, before we leave this earth, before we use up whatever life we have left, is going to make an enormous difference in what happens to the earth. See, I like to look at, you remember that picture on the Sistine Chapel that Michelangelo painted on the Sistine Chapel? The picture of creation, where you have God, and God is pointing a finger at man, and man is pointing his finger up at God, and basically the two fingers touch, and that's supposed to be the beginning of creation. See, I think that chiropractors in reality are the finger of God. I think we're the finger. I think we're the connection between God and man. I think we're the thing that enables man to become in the image and likeness of God. And I think that's what the adjustment does. I think when the adjustment clears the nervous system, which is where man lives, it enables him to become more perfect in the image and likeness of God. I heard something the other day which I really liked. And it was what the difference is between man and the rest of the animals. And it's very simple, but very profound. And it was this. God created man as the only creature who knows the difference between water and holy water. I think we're supposed to help in man understanding that. I think that basically is the function behind our function. Until next month, the innate in me blesses the innate in you. Peace.